Hey there, and thanks for venturing beyond the Rotunda, your Farmingdale Public Library podcast, where we often talk about literature, history, and community. But sometimes we'll answer questions like, which historic figure would you like to hang out with? I am your narrator, Kevin Schultz. Let's go pass some time. This is episode 14 of the Beyond the Rotunda podcast, a production of the Farmingdale Public Library, where we are more than just books. And as always, I thank you for joining me for this month's episode. We have made it through the dog days of summer, and autumn is right around the corner. The kids are going back to school. Football is just about to begin, and I'm very excited about it. The colorful leaves will be falling off the trees shortly. The time goes by so fast, and that is kind of what the theme of this episode is all about. The passage of time, or in essence, the creation of history. I'm going to be talking with academic Chris Kretz, K-R-E-T-Z, who is the host of the Long Island History Project podcast. So we will be talking a lot about Long Island history and a little bit about history in general. And on that note, let's get started by checking out our cover question. Which historical figure would you like to hang out with? Now, this one took some thought for me, as a lot of different names flooded my mind. For example, one of the first was Hannibal, because how awesome would it be to ride atop an elephant with this guy? But then I remembered I'm a little bit deathly afraid of heights. So I pivoted, and I thought of Amelia Earhart, because how cool would it be to fly around the world with her? But then I remembered, I'm still a little bit deathly afraid of heights. So I had to pivot again, and I landed on good old Ben Franklin, who kept his feet on the ground, but had his hands involved in everything else. He was a statesman, serving on the Continental Congress. He was an author, having written Poor Richard's Almanac, and helping draft the Declaration of Independence and the U.S. Constitution. He was an inventor, having created, among other things, the lightning rod, bifocals, and the rocking chair. He was a diplomat, having served in France for many years. And he was well known for being quite the ladies' man. This dude knew how to party. So hanging with him, I would learn a lot of new stuff, I would visit a lot of new places, I would meet a lot of new people, and we would have a whole lot of fun. So Ben Franklin is who is in my book. Let's find out who is in yours. We had more responses to this cover question than to any other question to date, and I find that so awesome. I can't thank you enough for your continued participation. All right, let's get into them. Sadie from Farmingdale writes, I live for true crime and mystery. I have always been intrigued about the disappearance of Amelia Earhart. Perhaps if I hung out with her, I would learn the truth of what happened to her. Sadie, I like this one. We do need to definitively find what happened behind her disappearance. Dolores from Farmingdale says, I have always been fascinated with Eleanor of Aquitaine ever since I saw the movie The Lion in Winter. She was married to a king of France and then to a king of England. She was the mother of two kings of England. She was the heiress to half of France, made a pilgrimage to Jerusalem, and lived well into her 80s during the 12th century. What amazing stories she could tell. Dolores, I think you would have a wonderful time hobnobbing with such royalty. Jack from Plainview says, I would think that hanging out with Queen Elizabeth II would be pretty cool. Who better to show me all the historic sites of England than the Queen herself? Jack, that is a good one, especially on this history-themed episode. Mary from Wallkill, New York, simply says, John F. Kennedy. And Mary, he is hard to argue with. Our 35th president lived quite the eventful life, even though he was killed so very young. Brittany from Kingston, New York writes, I can't decide between the pirate Anne Bonny, the abolitionist Harriet Tubman, or the mystery writer Agatha Christie. But they all were strong, intelligent figures who all would have great stories to tell. Brittany, those are three great choices, two of which did dangerous things, and one that wrote about dangerous things. Georgine from Massachusetts writes, too many to choose just one. How about I have a tea party and invite Albert Einstein, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Nelson Mandela, Eleanor Roosevelt, and Charles Darwin? Georgine, that is quite the intellectual tea party. Now, I'm not sure if I could hold my own, but can I be invited? Now we have Laura from Plainview who says, since I share a birthday with him, I would like to hang out and eat some cake with George Washington. Laura, our first president would be very interesting. You know he's got some stories. Chris from Whitestone writes, I would like to hang out with and at the Second Continental Congress. This has always been an interesting era to me, with a lot of interesting characters. Being able to see directly the pressures and hesitations that they had to try and navigate through declaring independence, fighting for it, and then establishing a new country would be amazing. Chris, I completely agree. My choice is also from this very same era. And finally, we have Shannon from Plainview. If I could spend time with one historical figure, it would be Jesus. His ability to love and accept everyone is truly inspiring. Shannon, that is a wonderful choice and something many of us should be striving for. Now, I thank everyone for sharing their thoughts. That was a great group of historical figures. Next month's cover question is going to be, what is your favorite book or movie that is either about fire or has fire in the title? As always, you can email me at beyondtherotunda@farmingdalelibrary.org or catch me on Facebook and Instagram. And now, let's turn the page to my conversation with librarian and fellow podcaster, Chris Kretz. We are here with academic librarian Chris Kretz, who is currently the head of academic engagement at Stony Brook University and the host of the Long Island History Project podcast. Chris Kretz, thanks for venturing beyond the rotunda.
Sure. Glad to be here, Kevin. Thanks.
Now, this is the first time we've actually met, but I've heard your voice so often from your podcast that I feel like I already know you.
It's an odd experience for me too. People that kind of parasocial relationship we have with podcasters.
Right. So now this month's cover question, I think, is appropriate as we're going to be talking a lot about history. With which historical figure would you like to hang out with?
Yeah, I put some thought into this and I'm going to go with Harry Houdini.
Oh.
The escape artist. He was roughly from 1870s, died 1926. He's a bit of a blowhard, so he'd probably dominate the conversation, but he was in vaudeville. He was a big performer in his day. He was in silent movies. And the other catch is he was a historian of magic. So he actually, as he traveled, he would look up the old timers in the city or in Europe. And so I would be able to ask him about the history of magic, old magicians he had met along the way. So I could dive even deeper than what he had experienced. So he would be my dinner companion.
Yeah, that's a great answer. It's the first time I've heard that. That's a great one. All right, so let's just jump right into it. Are you a born and raised New Yorker?
Yes, I am. I grew up in Queens. And so the irony is where I wound up as a child growing up in Queens. Long Island to me was not even an afterthought. It was, everything to the east of, for me, would have been like, Bell Boulevard in Bayside. So it's a little ironic that I wound up diving so deeply into Long Island history because it was not part of my surroundings growing up. But yes, a New Yorker, grew up with the, 70s and 80s. So sort of that low point of New York history, the kind of Ford to City drop dead, the Dave Kingman Mets.
Right.
But yes, born and bred, delivered the Daily News. We'll talk about college, but went away for college and then came back. And so I've been here pretty much most of my life.
Which part of Queens?
In Bayside, so Northeast.
Okay. I was in Astoria.
Okay, there you
Yeah.
go.
You mentioned it. Can you take us through your educational background?
Sure. So, throughout high school in Queens, Catholic boys' school, if anyone's interested, but then went to undergrad in Pennsylvania, came back, and after some time working in the city, went for my master's in library science from Queens College, so the CUNY system, and then moved out to Sayville about 30 years ago, about, and got a second master's from Stony Brook. And have been working in different colleges on Long Island since about 2000.
Okay. Now I introduced you as an academic librarian. Can you give us a little idea of what that is about?
Sure. So it's basically every college, university will have a library, and it's staffed by librarians. So, particularly my role, I'm head of academic engagement, is a lot of teaching. So we do instruction for different classes, helping students. No matter what they learned in high school, they always have to transition to doing college level research. So we're helping them use databases, how to think about research, how to form a good question in your mind. The misconception is that people that grew up using the internet are good at using it for research, which is not always the case. So you have to kind of slow them down or have them think a little more, nuanced about what's a good source or what's a good topic that hasn't been covered. So a lot of it is dealing with different subject matters and how do you research for psychology? How do you research for history? We do workshops on, writing papers and all that fun stuff. So we try to keep it interesting and let them know all the resources they have. It's amazing how much any library can give you, really. You've got databases full of historic maps, business data. We have databases of film scripts, which are awesome to go look through the Godfather shooting script. So anything you might possibly want to learn, we've got something to help them learn it.
So now, how does that differ from being the head of academic engagement at Stony Brook University?
Well, so head of academic engagement is sort of trying to coordinate and structure all the initiatives for instruction. So we go into classes, but then we also do workshops. We'll do online courses. We'll do pop-ups where we just try to show people, like, we're into AI these days. So we're trying to, what do people need to know about AI to use it effectively? So we'll do like a pop-up.
Right.
Here's five things you should know, or here's a tool we can demo. And is this good or bad? Or how do you think about it? So it's sort of coordinating a lot of efforts. I work with a lot of great people. And so we all have great ideas. It's just sort of marshaling that into the right channels.
With the advent of AI, did you have to kind of take a course yourself on that?
Well, I mean, any librarian, I guess we'd say we're constantly learning, right? So
Right.
when I started out in the early 2000s, the internet was just coming into full bloom. So we were teaching or trying to learn ourselves how to use AltaVista or,
Right.
search engine. So no different with AI. So we're signing up for ChatGPT. We're using all these different tools to figure out how they work, where they fit in. Is it, worth teaching to the students, or what do we have to tell them to look out for? So yeah, it's a constant ongoing. If
Right.
you like that type of work, then you might be a librarian without knowing it, if you like learning things.
Sounds like it's kind of gratifying, though.
It is, yeah. Again, if that's the mindset of, you like figuring things out, is researching and getting to the bottom or finding the answer to a question,
Right.
it's kind of that thrill of the hunt.
Are you a big reader?
I say yes and no. I used to read more. Lately, I would say I read mostly nonfiction stuff. I have a wife who's a high school librarian, so I'll usually grab something from her bookshelf if I need like a fiction, what's new in fiction. I can steal something from her to read. So, but a lot of it is I've been addicted to the screen probably as much as anyone. So a lot of it is scrolling online and
Right.
not so much X anymore, but following things online. So more of
Right.
a digital reader.
Is there any desire to write a book of your own someday?
Sure. Well, one thing, going back to the academic librarianship, we're required to publish if you're a faculty member, which I am. I have been at both my schools. So I'm always working on research, usually in the form of an article, but I've done some book chapters and I've got some historical topics I'm compiling notes on to hopefully write a book or two someday.
Nice. Want to share what it might be about?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of ideas, but one, which will be an answer to maybe another question is there's a long history of sports on Long Island, and especially to me, the mid 1800s, sportsmen coming out from the city, and there's a whole chain of racetracks and these sporting lodges they would go to, and these taverns where there's like stories about the famous, innkeepers that they would meet with, and these kind of tall tales about racing down Main Street and fishing for giant trout and stuff like that. So there's a deep history that I'm trying to put my arms around.
Sounds very interesting.
And they drank a lot. So it's a lot about what were they drinking in the 18? A lot of rum, a lot of mint juleps were big, interestingly. So
Wow.
I'm going through a cocktail list, cocktail history.
Lead you down different paths. Yeah.
Exactly. You got to go where it takes you.
So my understanding is your research took you researching libraries and radio and the history of Long Island took you into doing oral histories. Can you talk about the oral histories you've done?
Yeah, sure. And yeah, and I guess the through line to all that is, or one through line is the audio, the recording aspect of it, which I can't really say why that attracted me so much. But so the oral history part is, and we just did a quick interview with an oral historian. So you're interviewing people about usually about their life history or an event they were involved in. So I would say there's three main projects I've been involved in. So my first college job was at Dowling College, which was on the South Shore in Oakdale. And we did an oral history project based around the year it used to be a part of Adelphi, and then it broke off in 68, 69. So we interviewed students from the 68, 69 school year. We called it Born in the 60s, and it was asking them what was going on. Did they know the college was changing, which to them didn't really matter, but they were talking about, what music they listened to, the Vietnam War protests. So that was great, just the social history of it, interviewing all those students. The other big one, well, one of the other big ones is this Long Island home front, which is about 5 years ago now. We were working with a couple of different institutes trying to record histories of people that grew up on Long Island during World War II. So the home front, what was it like doing the scrap drives? What was it like? Some of them had family that were working for Grumman, and the blackout, the air raid drills, and all that kind of stuff. So there weren't too many of them left, which was the challenge. It kind of was a closing window to get to them, but that was fascinating. And then the most recent was at Stony Brook. We did a documenting COVID-19 project, so we were interviewing all sorts of people from campus, and it was actually while it was going on. So it was an interesting challenge. It was sort of like what we're doing over Zoom, interviewing them about lockdowns. There's one student who was working at Costco right as it all hit. So he was talking about, people panic buying toilet paper and all that. And then we also had people working in the labs at the Stony Brook Hospital and, coming up with tests and how do you run a hospital in that kind of environment. So it's going to be an interesting, I think it'll grow over time, the value of it, 10 years, 20 years from now. Anyone looking back to see how people reacted to it, I think there's some great interviews in there.
And those things are still accessible?
Yeah, those are online. The only ones that are not online are the Dowling ones, because Dowling went out of business in 2016. I've got copies of those. I'm not sure if a lot of the records went to Adelphi, so they might have the recordings there too.
And where can people find them?
So the COVID ones, if you go to library.stonybrook.edu, you'll find a link to our digital project. So you'll find a list of them there. And then if you just Google Long Island home front, they're listed on it. It's actually a college out of Maryland that hosts them, but you'll find most of them there.
All right. So now you've been podcasting since 2005, which
Yes.
to me makes you one of the pioneers.
It's an odd thing to think about. I did take a break, so I can't say continuously, but from 2005 to 2009, I was doing a library podcast at the Dowling College Library, which was sort of a foundational show for everything that I did after that. So that was involved. That was interviewing faculty members and interviewing students. We did some kooky, like dramatic readings of things.
Okay.
So we were experimenting. We were trying a lot
Right.
of different things. But yeah, it was new. I don't know how deep you've gone into so the RSS feed, we were doing that by hand back then, if anyone knows, can
Wow.
appreciate
Wow.
the challenge of that. Yeah, and that was fun because no one really knew what it was, but no one really what I found, and you tell me if you found this, most people I approach, no one has really been hesitant about being on the podcast. I mean, I did one in the early 2000s. We had a display from it was like an ACLU display on academic freedom or something, and there was a lawyer mentioned in one of the panels, so I called him up and I went to his office in Nassau somewhere, and I was literally holding up a this tiny USB mic in his face with my laptop because the cord wasn't long enough to record him, and who knows what he thought of it, but he agreed, and he was a great interview. So
Right.
yeah, so that was 2005 to 2009 was sort of that first wave. That's all pre-Serial, if you think of that Serial podcast as sort of a
Right.
high watermark. So this was sort of before that. And there were other libraries doing it. I mean, there's a fascinating history. This is something else I might write one day, but there were a handful of if you go back into the records, you'll see different public libraries, college libraries doing podcasting in the early 2000s.
Very interesting. Now, you did a podcast, I believe it was called Radio Tower.
Yeah, so there's a couple of transitions. So I kind of hung up the mic in 2009, and then actually the Long Island History Project grew out of a woman we'll talk about, Connie Curry, who was a local historian in Sayville, came to the Dowling Library because she had heard some of our other podcasts and said, would you want to help us or collaborate on a Long Island History podcast? And she was coming from the Long Island Radio and Television Historical Society, which I'm now the president of. So I joined up for. So we were
Nice.
kind of thinking of doing a radio history project, but it kind of morphed into all Long Island history. So we started doing that, and then we kind of lost the radio part. So I created a second Radio Tower podcast just to focus on radio history, which was interviewing old DJs, which was interesting. Stories of BAB back in the day, and
Wow.
what that was like. And even the deeper history. So there's like Marconi was on Long Island. So there's a deep radio history from like the early 1900s.
Now, are those still accessible?
The Radio Tower, I've got to upload again because we
Okay.
just sunsetted that, which meant the host deleted the files, but we have them all. So I just have to get them archived
Okay.
somewhere. And then, yeah, the Long Island History Project is still going. It's got 207.
Yep.
So they're all in the feed. If anyone subscribes or the web page, they can download them from there.
Well, we're going to talk about the Long Island History Project, but before we get into that, tell us what you think are the positive or negative consequences to knowing or not knowing our own history, whether it be local or global.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say I'm not a historian by training, so just because I work with historians that have done the doctorate, and so
Right.
I've gone as far as I've learned along the way. So I would say, there's a famous maxim, those who don't know their history are doomed to repeat it. I would say it's just knowing history. If you first of all, it's curiosity, right? So you want to be curious about what happened before, why things are the way they are. In a local context, what used to be on Main Street, why does the road curve around here? Because there was a farm that wouldn't give them the right to build the road, so they had to
Right.
make a big swing around. But also ideas, so like things that were tried in the past and maybe were ahead of their time or didn't catch on, that they did maybe years later. So like there's a history of electric cars in the early 1900s. It was sort of the road not taken. There were
Yep.
companies that were designing electric cars. And then, for other reasons, the oil companies and the internal combustion engine won out. But knowing the history that there was another way we could have gone, that idea may come back, right? So just knowing, history gives you all these options that were tried and failed, and you can see why they failed, and maybe try them a different way. So it gives you a lot of things to adjust. And I guess negative wise, I guess if you hold on to certain If you think of like feuds or just, animosities between
Right.
countries that go back centuries and can lead to, more and more conflict. So I guess if you don't let go of some things, you're not going to progress.
Which historical figure would you have loved to have interviewed?
Yeah, this is another tough one. I mean, I have people that are still living that I'd love to interview, but in terms of history, sort of, pie in the sky, and it will get to the cult perspiring, I think, but Caleb Brewster is sort of a character out of the past that I think would be great to get him, because I think he would talk. The other thing is, some people might not want to divulge their life story, but Caleb Brewster sounds like somebody who'd be more than willing to share what he did and his exploits. So he'd be a fun interview.
And he was involved in that cult perspiring.
Yep. He was the guy who drove, he rode across the sound to pick up the messages and bring them back. And he did a lot of, he was in raids. He had a whale boat, so they would use the boats from the whale boats as sort of like little assault vessels. And I think he had a little cannon mounted in the front, and he had this crew that would just go around and cause havoc. So interesting guy.
Sounds like it. All right, so let's get into it. What has been the mission of the Long Island History Project?
So the tagline or the intro is stories and interviews with people passionate about Long Island history. So it's a way, to me, in my mind, it's a way to bring to light people who have done the research. So it's usually not me talking about research I've done, although I do research to keep up and to ask good questions. But it's usually finding someone that has uncovered something or done, the digging, or an archaeologist, or someone who's lived an interesting life, and sort of giving them a platform to talk about what they discovered, sort of how they came to what they did. So these days, I feel like every episode I have a new co-host, because I'm trying to, get them to tell their story, which is fun. And so I like to jump around a lot. We go back in time to the revolution. We've done an episode on the glacier, which is 12,000 years, to living memory. So people that, the 50s, their memories of things that happened in the 50s and 60s. So that I like that there's no limit to the variety, just finding different pockets, whatever strikes, whatever comes up.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I did not know of the podcast until I found out about your name as being a potential guest here. And I've gone back and I've listened to at least like 50 episodes, and I
Oh, God
love
bless you.
it. I
Thanks.
love it. And I'm telling everybody about it. Everybody I
I
know.
appreciate it. Yeah, I mean, and then that's a challenge. And if we have time, I'll pick your brain in terms of marketing. And they say there's a discoverability problem with podcasts. Like, how do people find out about them? And it's at the local level, might be easier, might be harder. So I'm a little lax at getting Facebook ads or promoting it other than word of mouth. So if you have any secrets, let me know.
Well, I got a little bit of a promotional background behind me, support group with the library itself. So we have a social media department that will advertise. We have our newsletter that advertises. But I find for me most is my guests just telling, I'm going to be on this podcast, listen to it.
Yep.
And then it just grows from there.
So I'm expecting a Beyond the Rotunda bounce. I'll check the
I
stats.
hope we
Yep.
can
Appreciate it.
help. So tell us a little bit about Connie Curry.
Yeah. So to go back to the origin story, Connie Curry is a longtime researcher out of Sayville. She was a member of the Sayville Historical Society, worked at the public library. She's currently finishing up a book on a local architect, Isaac Green, who designed buildings for a lot of those mansions along the South Shore. So she has a deep roots in studying Long Island history. And she came to me while I was at Dowling College to pitch the idea of some kind of history podcast. So we brainstormed, and the first couple, I was just running the machinery, so I was just recording, but then I kind of slowly got pulled back on mic. And so and she's great because she knows everybody. So we had an episode where we were interviewing Marty Himes, who was a stock car racer back in the 50s and 60s. And she knew all the people he was talking about, like all these racers at the Riverhead Speedway and things like that. So she's got a great list of connections. And then just over time, the logistics, especially with COVID, it got harder to meet up. We used to do most of them in person. So we would actually meet usually at the Sayville Public Library and record in their conference room. And then it just got too hard to meet together. So she helped more with the Radio Tower podcast, and I kept the Long Island one going mostly remotely.
Yeah, I listened to that episode with the racetrack. That was very interesting.
He was fun. He was fun. And
Yeah.
the other thing, and this, a tangent, but the Long Island history, another thing I love having people on, to promote their work is people who sound like Long Islanders or New Yorkers, that
Yes.
our accents or for whatever reason, I like hearing that. So that's fun.
Very soothing. So
Yeah.
the podcast has been going on since 2014, I believe.
Yes. Yep.
Why do you think it has such staying power?
It just I guess sheer stubbornness in one sense. I just keep finding, there are, dark moments where I think, okay, I've run out of ideas, or the last three guests have canceled for whatever reasons. But then I usually find either something comes out of the blue, which is always great, or I'll find an article or something that sparks my interest again. So I guess with any podcaster, if you're in it for the long haul, it's just keeping yourself interested in the topic. And believing in it, thinking that there's some value in it. Because I don't know about you, I'm assuming you hear from viewers, or I get feedback, but it's intermittent, so it's hard to tell sometimes, is anyone actually listening? Well, you see the stats, so
You see the
know there's some,
stats,
yeah, you have some idea. But yeah, so it's sort of a mania almost. Like, if you keep it going for a long time, you have to have that commitment to grinding it out or keeping it going.
So, how do you go about finding your guests?
Yeah, it a range of things. I will, as a librarian, I can search databases for, the most recent publications. So a lot of times I'm looking for historians or academics who have written pieces, research that crosses over into Long Island somehow. One other avenue I've been taking to, I call it dissertation diving. So I'll go into who's written a dissertation, and usually people, sometimes they'll publish it as a book, but a lot of times they do that work and they don't have a forum to talk about it. So they usually love coming on and talking about the 7 years they spent researching this very niche topic. And then some of it is just people will call up, not call up, but they'll send an email or comment on a post, say, hey, I have a grandfather who did this, or, I've got a story. Would you be interested? What happens from time to time is somebody who has a book coming out, their publicist will get in touch and say, would you want to interview this person? So I'll take them where I can find them.
Exactly. Now, you always seem so well versed in your guests and your topics. What is your research process?
Yeah, so I try to read, obviously if it's a book or an article, I've read the article, I've read the book, I've taken notes. I'll do as much side reading as I can, usually looking in newspaper databases if it's like a, an event that happened. Check their other social media, Google Books. Have there been books written about it? Can you add context to it? 'Cause I don't like asking a question that I don't necessarily know the answer to, although that doesn't sound quite right. But I don't want to ask. There's times I've been surprised, which is always great, but you want to have at least a roadmap of possible topics.
You do it so well. I'm very impressed.
Well, the other thing is, as you know, and you can fix a lot of things in post.
Yes. We've been doing this for a little bit now. How does it feel being on the other side of the mic, answering rather than asking the questions?
Yeah, it's interesting. I know you just I listened to your interview with Natalie, who I also na interviewed, and she said, I'll say kind of what she said. It's weird, in a way, not being able to, not necessarily drive the conversation, but it's a good, I think it's a good practice though to do, because then you kind of feel what the other person feels sometimes, and I like it. It's interesting.
I've been on a few other podcasts myself in the past year, through Helen Keller and places like that. And it is strange. But you get used to it, and like you said, it gives you that other side of it, that other perspective.
And also, so I do all my own editing stuff. So I'm thinking, am I going too fast? Is he going to tighten this up? Or, so I'm trying to imagine in my head, in the back of my head, the final product. And, if you say to Natalie, hey, Natalie, cut this. I know she'll be editing later. But so you kind of have it's, and that, that's more when you're in the interview process too. I have to think as I'm interviewing someone, maybe they skip over something, so I have to remember, all right, come back to this, so we get them talking about this. So you have to sort of be producing in the back of your head as you're interviewing.
I've done
Oh yeah, all right, good for you.
that
You're good at this too. So
a
you
couple
were saying your wife got you, kind of suggested, what made you think you weren't ready yet, or what made you ready to start a podcast?
I didn't really know what topic I wanted to get into. This is back in 2019. And it wasn't until I started working here at the library that they immediately said, because I have a background in broadcasting. I went to the Connecticut School of Broadcasting. And so when they found out about that, they were like, podcast, you're going to do it. And I was like,
You're the guy.
okay. And then they just said, you develop it, you come up with the ideas and the guests, and I just run with it.
Yeah, if we can take a tangent, but I've been listening to a lot of yours, and I like the variety, and they're great interviews. And you had me at Bob Rozakis, because as a comic book reader, once I saw that name, I said, okay, this guy's for real.
He was great. He was great.
He was, yeah.
So, as a podcast interviewer, what question would you ask the academic librarian, Chris Kretz?
That's interesting. I guess one thing would be, why do you do it? Which I would have to come up with an answer for. It's funny, there's a I listen to a lot of other podcasts and public media stuff, and there was a recent series where a woman was kind of going back and sort of investigating her own techniques, and was she a good producer and all this kind of stuff. And she interviewed somebody telling her, I'm doing a series about creating interviews, and the woman said, why do you think someone would listen to that? And so that question haunts me every now. So, I would guess, do you think people are listening, or what value do you think you're giving to people? And I would hope I'm giving some value, just because we're exposing people that maybe don't get interviewed a lot. And the ideas, the interesting history they're revealing will be appealing to somebody at some point. So the other thing that I like about podcasts is, as long as they're up there somewhere, like you're saying, can you access them? You have that long tail. So somebody could discover it in 10 years if they're still there, or episode 3 they could listen to tomorrow. And even though I did it 10 years ago, they'll find it interesting.
Well, I think you checked off the value icon. What is the one historical Long Island moment or fact that every Long Islander should know?
Yeah, and I guess with all these, I'll say there could be a lot of answers to this, but the one that I've kind of landed on is just the history of the revolutionary history that we were occupied. We were British occupied from the Battle of Long Island to 1880, 1783, Evacuation Day. So just the trauma, the psychological effects, the physical effects of being under British rule, and the British turned out to be, they were not friends of most of the populace. They kind of were, bullies in a sense, heavy-handed. So the way they treated the Long Island landscape, it varied across it, but it was a dark time. So just that we went through that, and then I don't really know enough to say the after effects. Did it kind of keep us down? Like, if you think of other areas of the country that were subject to that kind of desolation, did it impede our growth for a while, that kind of stuff. But there it in terms of what we contributed to the revolution, one of it is that we suffered through that long span of occupation.
Yeah, that's something I actually did not know until I listened to the podcast.
Yeah, and I think it's out there, but you're right, it hasn't coalesced. If people know the turn, the Washington Spies miniseries or series was like a I guess a high water mark of getting that story out there, but it's still, most people probably don't know it still.
All right, so let's go way back. Can you tell us how and when Long Island was formed?
Yeah, well, one thing and there's a question about one episode I want to do eventually is the people who have written histories of Long Island, because there's different people over the years that have written histories, and they all start with the glacier. So I'll start with the glacier. If you, the 12,000 or so years ago, this giant glacier came down and kind of gouged out the and melted on top of us and created. So physically, we were formed that long ago. And then you had the Native Americans. So again, I don't know enough to say definitively, but the we're related to the tribes in southern Connecticut. And then there were tribes coming up from the south, the Lenape through Delaware. So there's that population was definitely here before us. And then there's a whole the post contact. You've got the Dutch coming east from New York. You've got different packets of Englishmen coming down from Massachusetts, and every group was trying to get further away from the other groups, right? So they didn't like Plymouth, so they would go to Rhode Island. They didn't like Rhode Island, they'd go to Connecticut, and then groups would start coming across the Sound, and so forming Southampton and all the pockets. So, I guess it really takes off, or the documentation takes off after, mid 1600s, and all these pockets of, what's interesting is, so you've got groups of settlers coming in, so maybe for religious reasons or whatever, they're forming a town. But then you had these huge manors. So, like, people in England would be given by the king this huge swath of land, in Smithtown or Moriches. And so it'd be like this little medieval fiefdom where one guy was kind of ruling everything. So there's this interesting history of almost like a Game of Thrones, like, this house, the House of Smith, in this area, and other, the Joneses down here. And so, and then it all kind of coalesced through a lot of stuff into Long Island.
Now, do you know where the first people settled on Long Island?
Yeah, I guess you'd have to pick a couple of, caveats. I mean, Southampton and Southold on the East End, I think, lay claim to that 1600, a little after Plymouth. And then, the Dutch were in New York City, and so they were forming settlements and farms in Queens and Brooklyn in the early 1600s. So it's roughly around the same time. You could pick different claims and argue which was the first, but so you had the basically the Dutch in the West and the English in the East and the North kind of moving towards each other.
What would you say is the most significant turning point in Long Island history?
I guess going more into the modern era, probably the bridges and tunnels once you connected us to Manhattan. And then,
That makes
if you go,
sense.
yeah, and so that kind of spread. But it's interesting. There's a lot of booms in real estate. So, like, even in the early 1800s, there was land speculation going on the island. So, history keeps repeating itself. It just, I guess, keeps going faster, maybe. But so, I would say, in terms of modern Long Island, once you had the infrastructure to get more people living further away from the city, so the train was doing some of that, but then the automobile early 1900s. So I would say around that time, the boom in transportation made it possible for people to move further east and settle, and then, sort of reinforce the people that were already there, kind of accelerate the population.
It's very interesting. I never thought about that idea of the bridges and the significance of them, but it makes perfect sense now that
Yeah, I did an
you said
interview
it.
with a Nassau County detective who wrote a book about this one killing spree in the early 1920s. And he was saying once they built the expressways, people could come out here, steal a car, do some robbery, and then get back into Manhattan really quick. So it has a lot of different effects you don't
Positive and
think
negative
of.
effects.
Exactly.
Is there a part of Long Island history that has been misunderstood?
I guess I don't have this all formed in my head, but I think maybe not misunderstood, but maybe not studied enough yet is sort of, so, the story is after World War II, a lot of the returning soldiers, Levittown, and, the housing boom in the immediate aftermath in the 50s, suburbia, and all that. I would like to dig more or hear more about the 60s, 70s, the modern late 20th century Long Island. So I think, there was a lot happening that maybe is not understood. How it happened, why it happened. So there's a lot of like redevelopment and housing, and but then you get into things like, the rise of hip hop in Nassau County around Hempstead. And so I think there's a it I guess it's not old enough yet to be considered history, but I think there's a lot there to be understood, better understood.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, do you think there's a gap because it's still considered too modern that would many people don't consider it history yet.
Yeah, but the other thing I found is somebody will research it, right? So if there's a historian that finds a topic, and one thing I was talking to somebody who studied whaling in Southampton, and he when he first found he was using these records from the town, and when he first found them, he talked to his advisor or colleagues about should I focus on this topic? And he said one thing he loved about it was that there were no footprints, meaning no other historian had studied it yet. So I think somebody will find something in 1980s Long Island that no one has studied yet, and they'll grab hold of that. So I don't think people avoid it. It's just a matter of, they have to find it interesting enough to dive into.
Is there a Long Island takeaway that you've learned from doing the podcast?
Yeah, I would say that there is no one takeaway, that there's an infinite variety. So again, we talk about early settlers. There's utopian settlements. So like Brentwood used to be modern times, which was these people just thought they could do away with money and kind of live in the woods by themselves. And then you had something like Patchogue, which was like all these mill towns and there, this heavy industrial thing. So it's sort of an island of infinite variety. You had mad scientists, Tesla doing experiments with this 80-foot tower. So, and then you had the, going back to the sports, there was huge racetracks and almost like a pre-Kentucky, people raising horses on Long Island. So there's a whole history of that. So I think anything that could happen has happened on Long Island. And so to me, it's just this big game board of interesting things that you can find just about an example of anything.
Yeah. And you can learn a lot about it on your podcast.
Yeah, hopefully.
Now, you have a recurring theme where you discuss other Long Islands from other parts of the country or even other parts of the world. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was, I'm trying to think when it first started. So, I mean, it was a way to find something to do sort of as an in-between other topics. Sort of like a something I could, if as I found them, I could do them to kind of break up the Long Island based stuff. So, and it turns out there's a lot of them. So there's one in Maine. The first one I did was in Maine because I was traveling through Maine and I saw the sign Long Island, Maine. There's a small one in Ohio. Well, the Ohio was more of a, it was Long Island Beach, was a family run amusement park. So this family just built these weird rides. The Australia was the latest. So this very small island off of Australia. So I don't know how I'll run out eventually, but it's just a kind of like a palate cleanser or a way to, recharge by focusing on something a little different, even though the name is Long Island.
Were you surprised at how many there are?
I was, yeah, and I have at least three more that I'm pursuing, and
Oh,
I'll
nice.
hopefully can dig up some more. I mean, it's a pretty, when you think about it, it's a pretty generic
Yeah.
description. And I will say, of all the Long Islands so far, we are the longest. So even though they're called Long Island, it's
Right.
usually like a small thing in the like,
We still
100 yards. Yeah.
win. We've mentioned it a couple of times, but another recurring topic has been the Culper Spy Ring. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, and I, this was a topic I didn't know much about until I came across it maybe 10, 15 years ago. So, just as background, if people don't know it by that name, it was a spy ring run out of Setauket by a lot of close friends and a major Talmadge who was working under George Washington in Connecticut. So it was a it was and it there's a lot of books about it. It was dramatized on AMC about 5, 10 years ago, and so it was. A known what's interesting to me somewhat is how it became known. So a lot of these they did not reveal their identities and the records did not expose them in a sense. So I think locally some people knew and it was written about in more obscure texts and things. But then there was this guy Pennypacker in the early 20s who was like he came across the records and started publishing about it and some of his stuff was right, some was wrong. So it was just this evolving story, and people are still finding out about it. So, they keep adding to the Culper spy ring. This person helped run messages for a little bit, and then he stopped. And this inn was a stopping point. Maybe they met here. So, it's not a done. It's not a finished story, but it is this story of people living under this British occupation, who might have even been loyalists at some point before it all started, and just seeing that they had to help smuggle information out. Real dangerous stuff smuggling. Records and so it's a fascinating, ever-expanding story, I think.
Yeah, I was very fascinated by it myself. Do you know if did they accomplish anything?
Yeah, I mean, historians vary, but they did, translate. They did transport some good information about troop movement. There's implications that they helped uncover Benedict Arnold's ploy, although it didn't get there in time. And the other interesting thing is, there's a whole spycraft history, but there were other spies that Washington was running in addition to the Culper, so they weren't the only ones, but they were keeping track of a lot of things in New York City that I think helped in the end. Yes.
Very interesting. You had another episode from 2023, which arguably might be my favorite. Can you tell us about the Grumman test pilot, Bruce Tuttle?
Yes. And that was great. So, I mean, there's a lot of variety and a lot of these are done over Zoom, but I like it when you're in the room with people. So this, we were in Port Jeff around a table with, I think there were five or six of us. We had more people than microphones, but it was the story. And Northport, they had done an exhibit on this, so I was sort of coming in just to do a more concentrated version of it. But and so there was the daughter there, the daughter of a test pilot named Bruce Tuttle, who was a fighter pilot in the war, and then became a test pilot for Grumman. And in the 50s, he crashed an experimental jet in the North, in the Long Island Sound, and. You know, she had mem well, she came a little after, but she had the family memories of it. And then a lot of the people on the podcast had done deeper research, and they had a lot of the background information, his actual transmissions during the flight. He survived, thankfully. So, and you know, they had information about divers who have tried to find it, and it's sort of this lost wreck. They don't really know where it is under the water. But yeah, so it was piecing together this history, mid-century history of Grumman and test pilots, and you know, it was a I guess a common occurrence. You would hear these jets going over your house. Amy said at one point that when her father was flying out of, I think Farmingdale, probably near it, he would buzz the house. So his mother, you know, his wife would know that he's okay. He's flying, and the dishes would rattle and stuff. So, but that's kind of one of the types of interviews I love, when it's like in living memory of somebody, and they're relating things they heard, or you know, their family's history.
It was a great interview. Amy really knew her stuff, and you know, she like it, I felt for her, you
Yeah.
know.
And you know, it's interesting because then you have to kind of pick through. It's almost like an oral history, but like, what did your father tell you about it? And then sometimes they don't learn a lot. They learn things later. So it's like sort of unpacking the story. And she had the helmet. That's one of my favorite photos. It's like she had his test pilot helmet. I think his call sign or his name was Salty. Once they, you know, fished him out of the sound, they called him Salty.
Do you have a favorite topic that you discussed on the podcast?
No, I would say not particularly. I'll go on a run sometimes. So there's a couple episodes where, for some reason, I got connected to the square dancing history on Long Island. So there was this huge history, not, well, huge enough. Jones Beach, they would have these huge, I think, Tuesday, Thursday nights. So there was the square dance caller was like a legendary figure in these things. So there's a whole lineage of square dance calling in America going back to, you know, they were doing it in Central Park during the war. And so I interviewed one of the latest people, who was an elderly man at the time, but he was talking about the people who taught him how to do it. And then I heard from that family, so I was able to interview somebody from, you know, so I had a few episodes where we were documenting square dancing history, which is fun. And then, you know, once in a while I'll do natural history, which is always interesting. Talk to biologists, and you know, one Plum Island Preservation Group was there. They know the history of the Plum Island, so they're trying to preserve it as a nature preserve, which led me to the Hempstead Plain. So Betty Galata and her group preserving this little piece of Hempstead Plains that are still in its kind of original state, almost undeveloped.
Since you mentioned it, how misunderstood is Plum Island?
I guess there's a version of it that's in the public mind, which is obviously the lab, and you know, the possibility of, you know, Lyme disease started there, which I don't think is true. But so it's next goes back to that like mad scientist, you know, aura of these, and you can say, you know, Camp Hero and Montauk Point. So I think it's understood to a sense, but I don't think anyone, or most people, probably don't realize the natural beauty of it, and the fact that there's seals on one end of the islands. Of, you know, it's a seal nesting place. And it's decom I have to check on the facts, but it's either decommissioned or being decommissioned, because this, you know, they moved that facility to the Midwest. So I don't know what the final plans are. There was talk of making it a resort or selling it to somebody. And again, this group wants it to just be a nature preserve. So yeah, I guess it's until people can go there, you know, once with if it's restricted, people are going to make up their own stories about it. So until you can have people going there for a day trip and, you know, hiking around, it'll change its perception.
The secrecy feeds into the conspiracy.
Yeah, exactly.
Is there a topic of personal interest that you haven't gotten to yet on the podcast?
I like sports are always a good topic. I've got one frequent guest, Fabio Montella, is always researching baseball history, so I always feel like there's more to do with baseball on Long Island. Like I mentioned, the horse racing, so getting deeper into that, I'd like to do. One thing I have to wrap my head around at some point is the formation of Nassau County. So 1898, when the five boroughs formed. I don't know if Nassau was kicked out or they refused to join. So how much of a drama was there when Nassau County was formed?
I'd
Would
be
be
interested in
interesting. Yeah.
that. Yes. And I'm stealing Fabio. He's going to be a guest on our show
Oh, great. You'll love him. He's great.
next year.
Okay.
Go
Sorry,
ahead.
other than that, again, I like personal stories when I can find them. So anything I can get. You know, one thing, and this goes back to the oral histories a little, talking to people who were teenagers in, say, the 60s or so. There was a lot of hitchhiking on Long Island, which always surprises me. So they say, oh, yeah, we would hitch here, hitch there. And then, no one seemed to care. So I don't know if I can do just an episode on hitchhiking, but I'd love to hear more stories of
Interesting.
people hitchhiking down to the beach and back. And, was it just friends that would pick them up, or was it ever a stranger or any weird hitchhiking stories?
Any horror stories associated with it? Yeah. How often do you get to visit and explore the sites that you discuss on the podcast?
I try to. It's usually after the fact. So, like, I interviewed somebody on Belport and sort of the history of Belport, and then I took a drive out to Belport because I had never been there. So it varies. I've talked to one guy. There's a historian who studies the British forts on Long Island, and they're hard to see. If anything, it's like a vague bump in the landscape, but they're out there where you can kind of. So that I want to do. I haven't done that yet, to drive by some of those. But yeah, I usually try to. It's usually not beforehand. It's usually after I talk to them, but then I try to go out and see what I can see.
Is there one site you would say that every Long Islander should go visit?
Let's see. I like the Walt Whitman Homestead. I did an interview there just to see, and it's kind of, wedged in between the mall and the highway, or this, so it's hard to envision the landscape that Walt Whitman would have seen. But I like that as just a reminder of that time.
I will have to check it out. On that note, who would you say is the most renowned Long Islander?
Yeah, well, that's a good segue, because I would probably say, I was going to say Billy Joel, which is probably a cop out or an easy answer, although he could be the modern one. But Walt Whitman, I think, still stands as the avatar, even though he didn't he lived here, and then he wound up in New Jersey, where he died. So, but he came back a lot. So I think, and especially with his writing and his history and the poems that have a lot to do with Long Island, I would still say he embodies Long Island probably more than most.
You mentioned it earlier. You recently interviewed Farmingdale Library's own local historian and archivist, Natalie Corsavides. Can you tell us a little bit about that interview?
Yeah, she was great, and I just listened to your interview with her, and thank you for the nice words you said about the history project.
You got it.
And it's funny because she said the same thing with you. She was a little nervous. She didn't have to be. She was a great guest, I thought. And I like, again, going back to the theme of sort of highlighting people doing the work as a Long Island, the local history librarian. Every public library, I think, probably has one or someone interested in it. So just highlighting the depths of knowledge that she's developed, and the kind of activities she's, the displays she's doing, the walking tours, the genealogy. You talked about genealogy. Just that these resources are there that people should know about, just to show the value that libraries have and the history of it. I really appreciated her time.
I'll be personally honest. I didn't know all the programs that we had here until I started working here. I knew some, but there's so many.
Yeah, and this is going back to the marketing, and I could say this even in my job here at Stony Brook. We do workshops, and we'll advertise, we'll put it on emails, and still people would say, "Oh, I didn't see that." So you never know what's going to reach somebody. So the more avenues, the better. And the other thing, and I'll ask you this question, because I've interviewed Natalie, I've interviewed a lot of Long Island librarians that are involved in history. Do you think at some point we'll all at some point be a guest on a podcast? Everyone will have a chance to.
I think that's a good question. I think that's very possible.
I think that's something to shoot for, because I think it's a fun experience too.
Yes, I like that.
Well, I guess, and not to derail this, but so do you look for people just of interest, or are you trying to find people connected to the library in some way or Farmingdale?
It's mostly, we started out mostly community interest. But we're branching out from there now. We're trying to get more
Okay.
national,
That.
I always thought I asked you, are you a New Yorker born and raised? That's always my first question, because that's where our base is. But there's been a couple that aren't, and we're getting out there.
Well, and this is another possible topic of writing something, but there's a whole ecosystem of Long Island-based podcasts now, more than there used to be, but a lot of other libraries. I don't know if you follow them, but
Yes.
Saville's doing one, Half Hollow Hills is doing one, Middle Country, Merrick. So I'm wondering, if you were to look at the guest list of all of them, are we covering a good swath? Like Long Island is very well represented in terms of podcasts, but it's all
Right.
local. So then again, it's the same question of, oh, I didn't know they were doing that. So how do you raise awareness that all these voices are being broadcast out there?
Right. It's difficult. So, can you tell us some of the episodes that are coming up in the future?
Sure. Well, at the moment we're still on an oral history kick. So I've been working with Rob Annan, who's works for this Long Island Library Resources Council. He's digitized a lot of these. So these are libraries or institutions that have these old recordings or cassette tapes. So not that old, but
Right.
some people may say old, and he helped digitize them. So we're kind of highlighting. We've done Manhasset Public Library, and so we're working on. I'm hoping Three Village will be next, which might tie into Culper land a little bit.
Right.
So we'll do a few more of those. Just and I like those types of episodes because I get to use a lot of clips. So I weave in the oral history recordings, and talk about Long Island accents. Go back like to the 40s and some of
Yes.
these. They sound like old movie actors. They're like Fred Mertz from the I Love
Exactly.
Lucy. Yeah, it's great. Yeah, and then I'm always chasing things. So I came across an article. There's a history of orchid growing on Long Island, going back to the early 1900s at least. So I'm trying to find someone to talk on that. I'm waiting for Fabio to write another book. Chris Verga, who's a prolific Long Island historian, has a book coming out in the fall on Nazis on Long Island.
Oh,
So
wow.
I'm hoping to interview him once that's published. So always something. If you have any ideas, Kevin, feel free to
I'll
pitch
shoot
something.
you. I'll shoot some your way. So where can everybody find you and the podcast?
Yeah, so the easiest way is longislandhistoryproject.org. That's the homepage. That's a free website where you can stream each episode individually. If you're into podcasts and you're using Apple or Spotify, you can just look up Long Island History Project and subscribe within the app and listen that way. But for, the average listener who's not a podcast junkie, just go to that longislandhistoryproject.org and you can pick and choose. There's a word cloud, which I like, has like, all the episodes on Saville or Amityville. The bigger the word, the more episodes we've done. So they tend to be closer to my house at some point. So there's a lot of Saville, but there's a lot of Culper Spy Ring you'll see and other things. So you can sort of pick and choose.
Great. Now I like to close out my interviews in a very similar fashion that you do by asking, is there something that we haven't talked about that you'd like to address?
You know what I was interested in? Because we talked about I've done a few podcasts, I've helped launch a few and sort of given advice over the years. And to me, two questions, two keys is coming up with the title of the podcast and the intro. And so what was your path to picking the Beyond the Rotunda?
So, Beyond the Rotunda, the name came from my wife. I was trying to think of something kind of witty, and we have a rotunda in the front of the building. And she said, "Well, why don't you utilize a rotunda?" And I was like, "Oh, yeah, we can, everyone goes in and out of the rotunda, Beyond the Rotunda." So that's where that came from. Beyond the
Okay.
rotunda into the building, Beyond the Rotunda out of the building.
Sure, could go either way. I like that. And then what do you remind me? You have like so what I've found is podcasts, it's a boon to the slow jazz industry because a lot of people start with a slow jazz intro. What's your
Yeah.
intro music? And I apologize if it's slow jazz because I don't remember.
Now, our intro music is from a local band
Oh,
called
great.
Max Seal, and the song is called Hideout. It's off their album Permanent Repeat. And I have a relationship with one of the band members, friends and whatnot. And so I reached out to them and they sent me that little intro.
No, it's great. Yeah, because
Yeah.
I mean, when you think about it, a listener is going to hear that every time a new episode. So you try to
Yes.
get something catchy, which I think you did. And you had a great interview with them. I was just listening to that this morning,
Right.
the Max Seals. Yeah.
Yes, they were a lot of fun, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, other than that, another tip, another thought, you should have your wife on. You should interview her since she seems to be a driving force and all that.
She was very integral in me being here,
Okay.
yeah.
Yeah, I guess. What's your sense of this kind of local podcasting? What do you see as why you do it, or what's the value? Do you think we'll still be doing this in 10 years, or?
Oh, I absolutely think it will still be around in 10 years doing it. I think it's only going to grow. I think that the main value is just getting, like you said, getting the word out there. There are so many things, whether it's local or national, there's so many things that people don't know. And podcasts have a way that they can reach so many different people. So yes, yeah, so that's I'm going to be here as long as they here at the library want me to be. So.
All right, that's great. Great. I'm right there with you. So we'll check in 10 years and see if we're
All
still
right.
going.
We'll do a second interview.
Yep. Yeah, no, other than that, I just want to thank you for your time. And like you said, word of mouth is being on other podcasts is something they always say is a good way to promote. So I was happy to talk to Natalie and mention your podcast. Thank you for having me on here. And I'll keep you posted. If I see that bounce, I will give you all credit.
Absolutely. Thank you. This has been fun and interesting, but we're not done.
Okay.
Of course, I always finish off by playing our end game. And for you, I have chosen pick your storyline.
Okay.
So I'm going to
What's that?
give
What happened?
you a scenario, and you got to pick your path.
You must choose, but choose wisely.
Okay.
So are you ready?
Sure. It's like Dungeons and
Okay.
Dragons, kind of.
Would you rather?
Okay. We'll do it that way. Good.
Would you prefer to have been a member of the Culper Spy Ring or a Grumman test pilot?
Probably the Grumman test pilot. You probably get a cool leather jacket with that. It'd be
That's
stressful, but not as stressful.
answer. I like that. Well, Chris Kretz, I thank you so much for being here. This is very fascinating for me. I thank you for helping preserve Long Island's history. And I want to encourage all my listeners to go listen to the Long Island History Project podcast. Chris Kretz, thanks for venturing beyond the rotunda.
Thanks, Kevin, and you're doing a great job, and I always look forward to new episodes. So thank you for all you're doing, and Natalie editing this if she's editing.
Yes. I appreciate it. Take care.
Okay.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Chris Kretz about the Long Island History Project and Long Island history in general. We do have a rich history here on Long Island. And the Long Island History Project does some amazing work bringing it to the forefront and preserving it. I do hope you all go and check it out. Now, I went to the first weekend of this year's Renaissance Fair in Tuxedo, New York. It was my first time ever attending, and I had an absolute blast. There were minstrel shows. I was told that everyone was in costume. There was a jousting tournament. And a living chess game. The food and drink were aplenty, and there were a bunch of shops and carnival games all around. In fact, this blind boy tried his hand at axe throwing, and not just one axe, but 14 axes. Thankfully, there were no fatalities or significant injuries. The only axe I was able to stick was in a net above the target I was trying to aim at. But even so, I had a great time. I would go back again, not necessarily this year. We spent far too much money to go again this year, but I would definitely go in the future. Maybe next time, I'll try archery. I want to once again thank Chris Kretz for being a wonderful guest. Max Seal provides our theme music. Natalie and Brendan do our editing. And as always, I thank you for listening and supporting the show. Next month, in preparation for Fire Safety Awareness Week, I plan on talking with first responder, firefighter Paul Kunkel. So tune in for that, and we can all learn how to keep ourselves fire safe. Until then, take care and enjoy wandering the stacks.